World News Today, brought to you by Admiral Corporation, in behalf of Admiral distributors and dealers all over America and in many foreign lands. By shortwave broadcast, direct from important overseas stations and leading news centers in our own country, CBS reporters are waiting to bring you first-hand news from the world's political and battlefronts. Now, here's Douglas Edwards.
Allied armies are hammering the German salient in Belgium from three directions today, and the 3rd American Armored Division has cut the Nazis' last escape road. Three strong enemy counterattacks in the area have been thrown back. In the air, at least 124 German planes were shot down today when the Luftwaffe came up to attack a strong American bomber fighter formation, at least 1,700 planes. The American planes flew in to bomb vital fuel refineries in north-central Germany. The Russian press is describing the Soviet winter offensive as the greatest blow yet struck by the Allies. And Pravda says that the Battle of Budapest alone is of greater magnitude and fierceness than anything that has yet taken place on the Western Front. In Italy, the Germans have set up a new winter defense line, bolstered by a new division and an abundance of supplies. American Super Forts bombed factories on the Jap home island of Honshu again today, and also Formosa, the great supply base for the Philippines. On Luzon, the Americans are 20 miles inland and looking for a battle with the Japs. And now, news radioed direct from Supreme Allied Headquarters. Admiral takes you to Paris, Charles Collingwood reporting.
As the German armies continue to retreat from the Ardennes salient, American troops have moved down from the north to cut the last main road leading out from the area the Germans are evacuating. This is the road from Houffalize to Saint-Vith, and we have cut it only 4 miles from the great road net of Houffalize itself. Of course, there are other minor roads leading out of the neck of the salient, but in the slippery, icy weather that prevails now, they will not support the traffic of the big road. Now is the critical time of the German retreat. Up until now, he's been able to move out in his own good time, and we've taken little toll of his retreating forces. But now we are narrowing in upon the Germans. We have cut their one good road. And after a week of snow and fog, the weather has providentially cleared, and all the air forces on the Western Front are up. Today looks like the day the air forces have been waiting for. The reports have only just started to come in, but up until noon today, the 9th Air Force alone had destroyed 170 motor vehicles and 3 armored vehicles in the salient, and that is only the beginning. The German salient is withering like a winter's leaf, and the next few days are the ones in which we may be able to turn it to our advantage. There is still a chance, but all the predictions made at the beginning of the breakthrough about how what looked like a German success may turn out to have been a German blunder, there is still a chance, although one says this cautiously, that they may have been right. The toll of dead and prisoners and equipment destroyed since the beginning is already very high. The enemy is now giving up most of the ground he won, and before it is all over, it may turn out that we have hurt him worse than he hurt us. This is Charles Collingwood in Paris, returning you to Admiral in New York.
From Charles Collingwood, news of the Western Front. And now for an interview with Congressman Outland of California, who is in Britain. Admiral takes you to CBS London, Larry Lesser reporting.
With the skies clear over the Western Front today, the Allied Air Forces at last got a chance to help the Allied soldiers hustle the Germans out of the salient. But it was a quiet Sunday in England, so tonight you'll hear from an American congressman who has spent just 4 days in London. He'll try to give you his impressions in less than 2 minutes, which is very little time for a congressman. Anyway, here's Congressman George E. Outland of Santa Barbara, California.
Thank you, Larry Lesser. 2 minutes certainly is too short a time. Not because a congressman necessarily must have hours, but because it would take hours to give even a summary of my impressions since arriving in England. I was told the weather would be cold. That I have found to be true. But I have been told that the people were cold. I have found them warm and cordial and friendly. I was told that London was devastated. But for every scar that I have found even more in courage and fortitude. I was told of the great scarcity of food and clothing. These and other necessities are strictly rationed. Oh, so much more than we in the United States realize. but I have found no scarcity of courtesy and no rationing of friendliness. My deepest impression is simply this. It is time, yes, far past time, for those of us on both sides of the Atlantic to stop bickering over trivialities and to stop quarreling over details. We must concentrate our united efforts on the big issues on which we are so mightily agreed. The issues of a full war effort and a just and lasting peace based upon the complete cooperation of our two nations and the other peace-loving nations of the world. We have been granted what is seldom given to individuals or to nations, a second chance. Please God, this time we do not fail.
That was Congressman George Outland of the 11th Congressional District of California. And this is Larry Lesser returning you now to Admiral.
More news in just a moment, but first, a message from Admiral Corporation.
Mr. Sweeney, just what can I expect to get when I buy a post-war Admiral radio?
The after-victory Admiral radios and radio phonographs will include all the proven features of Admiral peacetime radio experience when Admiral became the world's largest manufacturer of radio phonographs with automatic record changers. They will also be improved by the experience Admiral has gained through its all-out production of radio and electronic equipment for wartime uses.
Can I expect to get FM and television in my Admiral radio?
You will most assuredly get FM, and with it, the grandest static-free, interference-free reception you've ever heard. As for television, no one can tell you exactly when all the problems concerning television will be solved. But you can depend on it. When television is ready, Admiral will have it for you. In your post-war Admiral radio, America's smart set, you'll get value, excellent tone quality, and America's finest automatic record changer. For trouble-free enjoyment, be sure it's an Admiral. Now, here once again is Douglas Edwards.
Communiques from the Navy tell of the work of air groups, each consisting of one group of fighters, one of torpedo planes, and one of bombers. For an interview with a commanding officer of one of the Navy's finest air groups, here is Bill Slocum, Jr.
Scattered throughout these United States right now are a group of young men whose antics have caused the Japanese Imperial Fleet a great loss of face, to say nothing of the loss of two carriers, a heavy cruiser, 68 merchant ships, and about 450 airplanes. These young men, all members of Navy Air Group 19, are on leave now and are enjoying the beauties of home. With me now is their boss, Commander Hugh Winters of Society Hills, South Carolina. Commander Winters managed to get away from his official duties long enough to become one of the group's leading fighter pilots with 12 Jap aircraft to his personal credit. Before going into the more serious phase of Air Group 19's heroic activities, I would like Commander Winters to explain the novel use he has found for a whole chest full of campaign and medal ribbons he totes. Commander?
I've found this fruit salad a very handy weapon when confronting one of those haughty box office men in New York theaters. If you throw your coat back and let them see the ribbons, they're very often condescend to speak a civil word, and one or two instances to selling you a ticket to their shows. I mention this only for the guidance of any other service men in this wicked city.
You were under the command of Admiral Mark Mitchell, weren't you?
Yes, sir. And there's an aviator's admiral. He gets you in real close and he loses nothing. You can always be sure of something to come back to when he's running the show.
Commander, your group was in the Second Battle of the Philippine Sea and had a pretty fair afternoon, didn't it?
It did indeed, Mr. Slocum. We got two Jap carriers and along with other groups, we're in on the kill of four altogether.
Commander Winters was the target coordinator in that battle. That meant it was his job to stay over the scene of action and direct the naval aircraft toward the proper Jap ship. Tell us something about that, sir.
It was great fun watching three carriers burn and sink, but being target coordinator can lose you a lot of friends.
Lose friends?
Yes, our Navy flyers are pretty eager most of the time, and when they get a target assigned, each pilot feels deeply wounded if I send him after anything but the very biggest and toughest.
That shouldn't be too much of a problem for a man of your advanced years. The commander is almost 32, and a 32-year-old fighter pilot is pretty much a museum piece in our day. Tell us something, Commander, about some of the other men in Air Group 19.
Well, we're all pretty proud of the fact that 19 built up such a good record without any outstanding shining stars. It was more teamwork than spectacular individual work. But typical of the kind of men or boys were Bob Blakesley. He attacked 19 twin-engine bombers all by himself and got three before he was shot down. Don Banker was another. He was killed in Manila Bay just as his bomb scored a direct hit. Then there was Ensign Leaker, who refused to pull out of a torpedo run even though he was on fire. Those are just three, two of them gone, but they're pretty typical of all the boys.
They're also pretty typical of the air arm of the United States Navy, which is typical of just about the best America can offer. Thank you for coming by today, Commander Hugh Winters. Have a good time, keep on those box office snobs, and good hunting when you go back. Now back to Doug Edwards.
At General MacArthur's headquarters in the Philippines today, Admiral Sir Bruce Fraser said that powerful British naval units soon will join America's Pacific Fleet in striking coordinated blows at the Japanese. Incidentally, the commander-in-chief of the British Pacific Fleet disclosed that he missed death only by a few feet in operations incident to the American landings on Lingayen Gulf. And now for an interview with a pilot of a Piper Cub plane who has seen action at Leyte Island in the Philippines, we take you to Pearl Harbor. Webley Edwards reporting.
In our larger stories of the Pacific War, such as the current Philippines invasion, we often forget that every great battle is made up of hundreds of smaller battles, of which we hear little. Here is an officer convalescing from a wound in his leg made by a Jap automatic rifle, who, with his fellow officers and enlisted men, went through an action at Leyte that's worthy of a motion picture thriller. He's Second Lieutenant Robert Boone, whose father, John M. Boone, lives at Sharon Springs, Kansas. You were piloting a Piper Cub plane, Lieutenant, one of the little grasshoppers, is that right?
Yes, we were Bury Airstrip, 10 miles in from the east coast of Leyte. We had 12 planes at first, but the Zeros got some and the others burned. We only had 7 left when the Jap paratroopers and infiltrating troops surrounded the airstrip. There were about 125 of us, surrounded by several hundred Japs, completely cut off. We pulled the Cubs into a revetment area, and the Air Corps mechanics, searchlight crews, and Cub mechanics took up arms and built up a perimeter, a circle of defense.
Sort of a Custer's last stand, huh? Did you think you could hold out?
Yes, we were... felt pretty sure that the infantry would get into us eventually. But how long, we didn't know. There was quite a little fighting going on between us and the Japs, and we started getting some wounded. We didn't have a doctor, so we used the first aid kits we had on hand.
They rubbed my hands, which had been badly frozen, to start the circulation. They gave me plasma morphine. The only way out, my shoulder had been dislocated. When I came to, I began to fight, thinking I was still outside. However, they finally got me quiet, and I slept most of the way back to Saipan.
So, Sergeant, you really owe your life to that safety belt that you made for yourself.
Yes, I guess I do. The only mistake that I made was that I didn't have the buckles tight enough, and they slipped when the pressurizing was broken. If that hadn't happened, I probably wouldn't have gone out at all. They told me that a lot of the men in my squadron are now making the same kind of buffs for themselves.
So I don't blame them, Sergeant. Well, how are you getting along now?
Fine. The doctor told me they would be able to steady my hands. At first, they weren't so sure. But now they say at the most I may lose the end of one finger. They are still amazed that I was able to live so long without oxygen. I hope I will be able to rejoin my group, but it may be sometime yet.
Thank you, Sergeant James R. Cram. This is Tim LeMert at North Sector General Hospital at Schofield Barracks in Hawaii. I return you now to Admiral in New York.
We're back in New York now, and with Allied armies moving in on Germany from east and west, the German High Command finds itself, to put it mildly, in an unenviable position. To tell you something about it, here is Columbia's military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott.
From the point of view of the German High Command, the war situation must look something like this. On the east, the two heavily fortified flanking positions on which the defense of the Reich initially depended, East Prussia and Upper Silesia, have been overrun. East Prussia is in Russian hands, save for a small zone around the fortress of Königsberg. This releases, for further attack westward, the best part of two Russian army groups. Upper Silesia has virtually all been taken by the Russians. This deprives the Reich of 30% of its synthetic oil production and rather a higher proportion of its heavy industry in the steel and iron categories. It opens the way for a Russian assault on Breslau. In the center, between these two Russian forces, another Russian army group has surrounded Poznan and advanced to the border of Brandenburg-Pravitz, just under 100 miles from Berlin. The Germans still hold certain rail and road centers, Elbing, Graudenz, Thorn, and Poznan, which impede and delay Russian movements of heavy forces toward the frontier. But these centers are only time-gaining expedients. What is needed is more troops for the defense of the open frontiers of the Reich and the approaches to the Reich capital from the east. On the west, the time-gaining counterattack in the Ardennes has failed with heavy losses. The V-weapons have damaged the Anglo-American allies, but have not prevented the gathering of powerful forces and vast amounts of supplies through the port of Antwerp. The diversion in Alsace has not produced any results worth mentioning. Now the Western Allies, having pushed up to the Ruhr River all along its course, are getting ready to jump off into the Rhineland with a major offensive. Time-gaining expedients on this front have already been exhausted. What is needed is more troops for the defense of the vital industries of the Ruhr and the Saar and the approaches to the Reich capital from the west. But where are these troops to come from, either for east or west? Wishing that the 30 divisions in Italy were behind the Alps is not very helpful now. Getting them across the Lombardy plain under the hail of fire from Allied air power would be quite another matter. From Norway, from Latvia, a trickle of help may come. But the imperiled German frontiers to east and west need not a trickle of reinforcements, but a flood. Call up the 15-year-olds? That might be done, as the 16 and 17-year-olds have already been called. But the cradle can be robbed at once. Withdraw to better and shorter lines of defense? Well, a withdrawal to the Rhine in the west might gain a little time if it was suddenly done and the weather gods were kind enough to cover it. But the coordinated pressures from the two fronts continue with inexorable power. Sooner or later, the German high command may find themselves confronted with the grim choice of which of their frontiers shall be defended at the expense of the other. Too many Germans have been killed for both to be defended indefinitely. For this reason, perished the Empire of Napoleon. And for this reason, more than a century later, the empire of Adolf Hitler is going down in blood and fire. Now, here again is Douglas Edwards.
You've heard Columbia's military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott. One of the War Department's top ammunition experts is standing by a CBS microphone to tell you about our Army's needs. For a talk with him, Admiral takes you to CBS Washington, Tris Coffin reporting.
Every two or three days, the War Department gets a cable from a commander in the field asking for more ammunition, more firepower. We've asked one of the generals responsible for making good on these cables to tell us a story. He is Brigadier General Roswell E. Hardy, Chief Ammunition Division, Industrial Service, Office of Chief of Ordnance. General, why is the need for ammunition so urgent today?
There are several reasons. Our troops on the Western Front are right up against the Germans' fixed fortifications, concrete and steel pillboxes. Then, too, the Nazis are using heavier tanks, and we must have powerful explosives to knock them out. The third reason is the most important. The American Army believes in saving men wherever possible. The more firepower you have, the fewer casualties. Every time our ordnance workers at home raise their quota, they are saving the lives of GIs.
General, I've heard the criticism that while you're asking for more production, some plants are still being shut down.
I'm glad you brought that up. The truth is that needs for various kinds of ammunition change all the time. We start producing full blast on some particular shell, and the word comes from the front that it is obsolete. War moves very, very swiftly. We must meet the challenge of the enemy's ingenuity, of his defenses, and of his firepower. The Germans are making bigger and tougher tanks. We must have the ammunition to pierce those tanks.
Do you have any other examples you could give us, General?
Sure. We are making a shell to pierce one sheet of steel and increasing production. At that time, American inventive genius plus necessity brought out a shell which could penetrate three pieces of steel. That, too, has been thrown out the window because we increased the penetrating power even more. We have now been forced to build new plants for the latest type shells. The Army didn't change its mind, it changed its ammunition. And here is another case. We started out making 100 and 250-pound bombs for the Air Force. Then we stepped it up to 500, 1,000, 2,000, 4,000 pounds and larger. At the present time, we are setting up plans to make more of the smaller weight bombs, which we stopped making months ago. Sounds contradictory, doesn't it? Well, here's the reason. The Air Force found by experience it can do more damage against certain targets with smaller bombs than it can with one big one. Now, when a plant is shutting down, it doesn't mean the war is over. It means we have improved our firepower and the need for production has shifted to another plant. I know of one case, for example, of a plant where we are shutting down one or two lines while we are building new lines at the same plant. The reason is that lines which load 20-millimeter rounds are not suitable for loading a 1,000-pound bomb.
Can you tell me any of your latest type ammunition developed to meet a special need?
We are now producing a special concrete-piercing fuse. When it is screwed on a high-explosive shell and fired, the shell will pierce 6 feet of concrete. That was developed to smash those tough German forts in the Siegfried Line.
Was there any decline in ammunition during that period when some people thought the war was about over in Europe?
No, because the closer you get to the enemy, the more firepower is needed. As a matter of fact, ammunition production has increased every month for over a year. Last January, we turned out $225 million worth of ammunition. During this last December, we produced $390 million worth. And I can tell you those shells are not lying around in warehouses in this country. During December alone, we loaded 600 Liberty ships with ammunition for the fronts. That amounted to about 600,000 tons of ammunition.
General, do you look for any slump in ammunition production after the fall of Germany?
As we see it, the demands in the Far East are so great that production must continue at a high rate for months after the fall of Germany. It's the same thing again. The closer we come to the enemy, the more firepower is needed.
Thank you, General Hardy. I return you to Admiral in New York.
About a minute and a half ago, an order of the day arrived from Moscow from Marshal Stalin. He said that Soviet troops have captured Memel. That city is on the Baltic coast, up above Königsberg. Well, ground activity on the Italian front has been limited to patrolling for the 22nd straight day, but it was officially announced in Rome that large fires have been seen just behind the German Senio River winter defense line in the 8th Army area. The meaning of these destructions is not explained. The fires, which were seen burning at Cufiano on the west bank of the Senio, 6 miles west of Faenza, constitute part of the unexplained activity which has been observed behind enemy lines recently. There were a series of heavy explosions in Lugo yesterday. The dispatch didn't indicate whether demolitions were made by the Germans or by Allied patrols or Italian resistance forces. And now, once again, here is Warren Sweeney with a word from Admiral.
Remember when an evening's entertainment for the whole family on a cold winter night was to sit by the fireplace and look at travel ads and summer resort folders? You'd plan next summer's vacation and get real enjoyment from the anticipation of sun-swept beaches or an isolated cabin. And remember, in some remote lakeside or a mountain resort, practically your only contact with the happenings of the outside world would be your Admiral portable radio. It's true we haven't had those restful vacations for the past few summers, but with the war's end, they'll come again, and there'll be a new and better line of Admiral portables. Admiral portable radios eliminate the chance of power blackouts because they'll operate equally well on AC, DC, or battery current. Admiral engineers have profited by their wartime experience in designing and building communications equipment, radio, and radar for the armed forces, and they're still hard at it. Admiral's wartime production was three times as great in 1944 as in 1943. Admiral Corporation is the world's largest manufacturer of radio phonographs with automatic record changers. And you can look for some exciting new features in every model of every Admiral radio, America's smart set. I'll bet you'd give almost anything to speed the day of victory so your fighting man would come home, wouldn't you? Yes, we all would. And the surest way to speed that day is to give them the tools of victory by our continued purchase of war bonds. Let's buy more and more and more till victory. World News Today is brought to you each Sunday at this hour by Admiral Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's smart set, and post-war makers of Admiral dual-temp refrigerators, Admiral home freezers, Admiral electric ranges. Be sure to listen again next Sunday when Admiral brings you World News Today by shortwave, direct from leading news centers of the world. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
The WBBM Air Theater, Wrigley Building, Chicago.